Okay, it's an honor to be here. I'm grateful to all those who came, as David said. And I just want to give you an overview, essentially, of the packet which was given out. They were floating. I made 50 copies, so I think that should cover for everyone. If you didn't get one, please raise your hand. And if anybody has the extras, does anybody have the extras? Okay. So pass it around. You could float it. Thank you. Okay. So the handout which you have before you has an outline on page 3, I guess, followed by some halachic source material and rabbinic source material, and a couple of very short items from the internet, which relate, of course, to the subject which we're going to be getting to, and we're going to conclude with a brief little shiur based on the rules of the police vis-a-vis the Torah. Now, in the outline, I want to make clear. I did receive an email from somebody who was in this room today about the I'll call it the heated nature of the title of our class, which is Cases Studies in Dina de Malchus Adina. Dina de Malchus Adina is a Talmudic term which refers to that the law of the land is the law which Jews must follow, certainly in the land of Israel. And of course, outside the land of Israel, any place where Jews find themselves the beneficiaries of a malchus, especially of a malchus shel chesed, of a kingdom of kindness, but any place where the Jews were allowed to live, in many cases the Jews were, especially in Europe, Russia, as we all know, knowing history, Jews were allowed. Sometimes they were levied heavier taxes, but they were allowed to live basically with freedoms. Actually, for many years. In different areas of the world, Jews were subject to their own inner policing, if you will. I don't mean policing, but I mean their own laws. And as long as they paid the taxes to the local authorities, the Jews kind of worked within their own system. So, but in our case now, in the land of the free and the home of the brave, in the United States of America, and especially of late, some big issues have hit the news. And especially on social media, now that nowadays, you know, we have between Facebook and Twitter and just the concept of the blogs which are out there, where everybody who has an opinion about something can weigh in and say, oh, this is what I think and this is what I know. So people have many differences of opinion, of course, and so of course what I'm going to be sharing tonight may be partially biased towards my own opinion, but at the same time I'm trying to keep level-headed and to throw it from a perspective of what the Torah and Halacha has to say about it. And so, having said all that, I want to make clear that with the two particular cases which we're looking at, the Fort Lauderdale ordinance prohibiting the feeding of the homeless, we'll try to understand better what that means. Is it actually prohibiting the feeding of the homeless? And of course, the second question of how would Halacha rule in the cases of death by police that have been in the news. This is not a question of whether the people who died in these cases or the police are right or wrong. We're going to take the case on its own merits and try to understand how would Halacha rule in those particular cases. In other words, if the circumstances were not that this is the United States of America and we're governed by the law of the United States, the law of the land, etc., but in fact we're governed by a law of the Torah, And that those who are presiding over the case would be a Beis Din, what would be the ruling in these particular cases? Firstly, if the ordinance prohibiting the feeding of the homeless, as it were, not that that's a very good description of it, but whether that has halachic basis, is it something which the Torah would allow for? Is it something which, if it were brought to a Beis Din, to a Jewish court, what would they say about it? And of course, in the case of these circumstances where individuals died at the hands of the police, so what would Halacha say about that? In other words, were those who died in the right or in the wrong? Were the police in the right or in the wrong? Does Halacha have wiggle room to allow for the police to use force in order to achieve their particular goal? So I'm not judging. I want to make that clear. I'm not saying whether the police were right or wrong, whether the persons in question were right or wrong, though obviously I believe most of us would be in agreement that had they followed the police instructions, that they would all probably be alive today. Okay, so we'll bear that in mind, of course. But we're looking at this from a theoretical perspective of if halacha were ruling, what would be the case? Okay, so with that in mind, and just to further the point in our introduction, we're gonna take a few minutes to define what dina de malchusa dina means, what it is, and how we could therefore decide whether it's even applicable in these types of cases. Okay, so please open up your source sheet. I'm not going to read all the Hebrew sources inside. I've more or less summarized it, and actually I'm indebted to Rabbi Josh Flug for some of the sources that he prepared for a shiur, not about this topic specifically, but some of the things which he prepared to a related question of the concept of civil disobedience versus conscientious objection. What is the difference between those? Civil disobedience is actively violating the law of the land in order to uphold one's moral convictions, whereas conscientious objection is refraining from a mandatory activity based on one's moral objection to the activity. Okay, so one is specifically violating the law, whereas one is not following the law. Okay, just to give an example which is very relevant in Florida, okay, and in general in the South, many people don't abide by the laws of speeding. Now, we may or may not decide whether they have a moral objection to speeding or to having to be confined to the speed limit, but that, so, you know, we could debate whether that's civil disobedience. I mean, technically it is civil disobedience because we're breaking the law when we speed. Well, on the other hand, if a person really had a moral objection, no, I think that there's something morally wrong with having to drive only at 65 when my car can go up to 120 miles an hour. So that might be viewed as a conscientious objection, were it not actually breaking the law. So it is breaking the law, and I'm not advocating it by any stretch of the imagination. Okay, so now let's take a look at what Dina de Malchusa Dina is. So the first source that you have, which is on page 4, is the Shach and Choshen Nishbat. And the Shach and Choshen Nishbat is really talking about a case where Choshen Nishbat, of course, is a section of the Shulchan Aruch which focuses on rules, monetary disputes. In this particular case, the Shulchan Aruch is talking about cases of shtaros, of documents which have been utilized for the transference of particularly property. Okay, in some case, in the course of the conversation, he brings up documents which are for inheritance. In other words, what happens if a woman dies, for example? So who inherits her property? So the law of the land says one thing, and halacha, of course, says that her husband, if her husband is alive, inherits her property. So the question which is raised here, and I cut out a lot just to bring out what the Shach focuses on. But one of the themes which he keeps raising is, when it comes to Dina de Malchusa Dina, and essentially, I mean, I summarized it here, the monetary cases in which halacha has something specific to say about it, whether it's how to read documents, who is a viable witness, what it means to transfer property, who inherits whose property, for all of this we apply the rules of the Torah. But when it comes to rules of the land, which are done for the benefit of the king or the populace of the city, we follow the law of the land. The phrase which he keeps on repeating is, just as an example, take a look at the last four lines in Hebrew. Okay, he says, you know what? We'll actually look at the last eight lines because that's a good summary. He says, "The law marina dina de malchus adina el b'davar sheyesh bo hanal lemelach oshu litakanas b'nei amadina." We don't say, you know, we don't apply the rules of dina de malchus adina except for something which is specifically for the benefit of the king, or which is something to litakanas b'nei amadina. In other words, for the benefit of everybody who live in the land. Especially something which halacha doesn't have something very specific to say about it. But we don't go to the courts of the non-Jews when it becomes a question of something which specifically violates or goes against our Torah. He gives an example there, what happened in Be'er Shushan. That the rules of Dina Melchusa Dina apply when there's something which is a benefit specifically to the king, or something which is to the benefit of all of the land. Kegon Shein Machshirim, Eid Echad, Afilu Hukaru V'Pasul. But any other laws, when we have rules of the Torah, which are very clear in between us, for example, the law of the land may allow for one witness, even if the person is a relative or otherwise invalid as a witness. Or anything which is private between one Jew and another, okay, for which the Torah may have an answer. Certainly we're not going to follow the law of the land when it comes to a dispute between two Jews. Because if we don't follow our halacha when it comes to something which is a halachic question between us, so what we've essentially done is we've canceled out the Torah. And that is something which we do not have, which we do not have room to do. Okay, generally speaking, so what the Shach lays out for us when it comes to the rules of Dina de Malchus Adina is that especially if there's a monetary dispute which can be resolved based on the halachic laws which are in our books, which we can resolve amongst ourselves, so we should be doing that. Because Dina de Malchus Adina, the rules of the law of the land apply when it's something which is, in general, for the nation, or perhaps for the benefit of the king, or the ruler, as it were, then Dina de Malchus applies, and we have to follow the law of the land. But if you and I have a dispute about, rent, let's say, you're my landlord, I'm your landlord, and we have a fight about that, so yeah, there may be rules about that, but that's something which Allah has something to say about. So we're supposed to go to a Beis Din, and we're supposed to resolve that issue between us. But if there's a question about the law of the land, okay, for example, the first case which we're going to be looking at, where there's an ordinance which is made that there are certain rules about where you're allowed to feed the homeless versus not. So halacha doesn't have anything to say specifically about that. Sure, we have rules about taking care of the needy, absolutely. But when the law doesn't say you may not take care of the needy, if the law said that, then we would ignore it because we have a mandate from the Torah to take care of the needy. But the rule doesn't say that, and I'm going to read to you soon what that rule actually is. So Dina de Malchus Adina, in that case, in other words, in the case, if it said not to feed the needy at all, then it wouldn't apply. We would have to violate that. We can call that civil disobedience. But when it says to do it under a certain framework, so then Dina de Malchus Adina applies, especially if it applies to everyone, as we'll soon see, and especially if it is not violating the laws of the Torah. Let's take a look at the next few. So I'm going to look at the summaries on page 5, but I gave the full sources for those who are interested in reading through these. So the Rashbam tells us in Baba Basra that Dina de Malchus is based on the fact that the citizens of a country accept the law of the land as a condition of living there. So if the laws are for everybody, again, just following along the same line of thinking, if they're for everybody and they apply equally, then the Rashbam says you must follow them. The Rambam in Hilchos Gezela Ve'Aveda, so he tells us a little bit about what happens if a king in Halacha Yud Zayin, he tells us what happens if a king cuts down trees which belong to people and he makes a bridge. So you're allowed to use that bridge. If he knocked down houses and made a road or some type of wall, so we're allowed to benefit from that road or wall, and it's not considered as if we're stealing because the king's allowed to do what he's allowed to do. When it comes to Halacha 18, that's what's summarized here. Dina de Malchus only applies if the people recognize the government as a legitimate government and accept its sovereignty. Otherwise, the Rambam says Dina de Malchus does not apply, and the money, property, or property that is taken by the government is considered stolen property. So again, the theme which we're going to be seeing here is that as long as the rules apply to everyone, and they are rules which everyone accepts simply because they're living in that place, right? If I don't like the rules in this country or in this state or in this city, I'm allowed to move. I can leave. I don't have to follow these laws if I can go somewhere else. And that opportunity and that option is always available to me. I mean, if I'm stuck there, if there's an iron curtain, there's a different discussion. But when you're living in a place where there isn't an iron curtain and you aren't stuck where you are and you can theoretically get out, when you're living in a place, you're assuming that those laws are applicable to you, and therefore Dina de Malchus Adina would apply when it's a legitimate government. Okay, the Maharik was a 15th century commentary. He's a teacher, I believe, of Rabbi Avadim of Artanura. He deliberates between where Dina de Malchus Adina applies only to property lines, and he extends it to rules that apply throughout the land. In other words, the law must apply equally to everyone. So that's the summary. He summarizes there what I've been saying all along, that as long as it's applicable to everyone, then the Dina de Malchus Adina would apply. I apologize in the next in the next source that I cut it off a little bit. This one I had to copy off of a screenshot, so, and I fiddled with the size. So I apologize. But Rabbi Gestetner writes that Dina the Malchus Adina applies certainly does not apply in situations where there is persecution, and it only applies to monetary consequences, assuming that the taxes are reasonable. Now this is not so much applicable to the questions which we're going to be addressing today, but again, as long as it's reasonable, then Dina de Malchus Adina applies. That's the idea which we're taking from Rabbi Gestetner's comments here, that if the law is a reasonable law and it's something which could invariably be followed, if people were to only look at it and say, I guess this is not so far-fetched. It's not, you're not tying my hands behind my back. You're not making my living in any way something which is unbearable. It's something which I could certainly follow. Then Dina de Malchus Adina would certainly apply. Now the Ramban actually has a very specific insight, because he, in his commentary here in Baba Basra, he tells us that the term that is used is Malchusa. Dina de Malchusa, Dina apply. Dina de Malchusa literally means the law of the Malchus, of the kingdom, and not Dina de Malka, the law of the king. So he says the fact that the term that's used is Malchusa, not Malka, indicates that Dina de Malchusa does not apply laws that one specific king instituted. They must be laws that are generally accepted across most kingdoms. Now, if we were going to apply that to our situations here, so we're not really looking at kingdoms per se, but we're looking at the United States of America, or perhaps cities across the country, because, of course, there are states' rights, and states' rights say that every state is allowed to make their own rules, and of course, within states, you know, our question today, we're looking specifically at Fort Lauderdale. Within cities have their own rules, laws, ordinances, etc. So if there's precedent, for example, this is what the Ramban is arguing. If there's precedent for a rule or a law that a city or a state is going to apply to its particular situation, and it's not something where they're just jumping out on a limb here and they're doing something only of their own accord, then Dina de Malchus Adina would apply, because it's not so much about the Malka, you know, the mayor of one specific town who has a crazy idea that he is, you know, or she is, I'm making a rule because this is what's important for our city. This is important for our area. No, but there's precedent for it in other places, in other cities, towns, or even states. Then Dina de Malchus Adina, the law of the land, would apply. The Rambam in Hilchos Malachim, Laws of Kings, says even if the king doesn't directly institute something against the Torah, but his decree interferes with the Torah, even a mitzvah kala, one is not obligated to follow the king's rule. Okay, so I mean, let's just give an example. Let's say just to kind of jump off where I mentioned before, if the law of the land, or if the king were to say nobody is allowed to help the poor or the needy. Okay, now that clearly contradicts the Torah. We're all familiar with the rules of tzedakah. We're all familiar with the mandate, the Torah, that we have to take care of the ger, the yasom, the almanah, the stranger, the widow, the orphan, the people who are most needy in our society, whoever they may be. I mean, when it comes to the holidays, for example, the Torah tells us a number of places. You have to take care of the ger, the yasom, the almanah, the levi, all the different people in your society who, for whatever reason, can't take care of themselves. We have that mandate. So if the law of the land were to say, that's it, you're not allowed to do that anymore, then that is a place where the Rambam says, we don't listen to the law of the land, because it directly conflicts with the rule of the Torah. If the law of the land were to say, you're not allowed to put on tefillin, so every man in this room would be obligated to defy that law. Okay, we are all familiar with stories in the history of our people where a law. I mean, we're in Hanukkah right now. The perfect example of Antiochus outlawing Bris Mila. Well, you can't outlaw Bris Mila to us. That's a mitzvah from the Torah. So we're going to continue to do that. It's amazing that in Russia, behind the Iron Curtain, that the Jews. I mean, it was so monitored that they couldn't pull it off. But in our history, we know of so many cases where Judaism was outlawed, and the people at risk of life and limb did what they could in order to not follow that law, because it went against the Torah. We know that Bris Mila is under attack in some places in the world. Shechita is under attack in some places in the world. The Jews are going to continue what they're going to do, and if they can't, they're going to leave because they're going to follow what the Rambam is going to say. Where if it deliberately goes against what the Torah says, that we are not obligated to follow those laws. Okay, so thus concludes our introduction to the class tonight. Before we go into the specific case studies, understanding what Dina D'Malchusa Dina is and what Dina D'Malchusa Dina is not. If it's something which applies to everyone, we have to follow it. If it's something which is specifically against the Torah, we do not have to follow it. And of course, when the kingdom that we're living in, and in this case, the United States of America, it's not so much a kingdom, but it's a government which has rules and laws and checks and balances, and votes and committees. So we can assume that when laws are made, they're not specifically made to target any specific group or individual, because there are discrimination rules and there are watch groups who are watching for all these types of things. I mean, there are websites dedicated to defending the homeless. There are websites dedicated to defending all types of areas where people might discriminate, and especially lawmakers might discriminate against others. So we can take for almost granted. I'm not going to say completely. But we can take for almost granted that the law of the land, when it is made, especially by voting, especially by committee, by elected officials, is something which, even if we don't like it, even if we don't like it, it's a law which must be followed, because those are the rules of Dina D'Malchusa Dina, as long as it doesn't go against the Torah. And certainly when halacha doesn't say anything about the particular point in question, it should be followed. Dina D'Malchusa Dina, generally speaking, is not something which we're going to follow when we can specifically take care of the case in question through our own means, through our own Beis Din, through our own court. And that usually comes up in civil disputes between our neighbors. If people have a monetary question, if people have some type of some fight over money or whatever it may be, so as long as Beis Din has something to say about it, then we'll follow the rules of Beis Din, as long as it's not overtly contradicting the law of the land, unless the law of the land doesn't really care if you can resolve the matter on your own. You know, if I have a dispute with somebody, and you know, we could resolve it in court, or we could say, hey, listen, you're a reasonable person, I'm a reasonable person, let's figure this out. The law doesn't mandate that we have to go to court if we can figure it out. And essentially, that's what Beis Din nowadays serves as for us. It's a place of mediation. It's a place where you have basically arbitration. So if two people can figure it out amongst themselves without having to resort to going to the court, a secular court, and following the law of the land, because they figured it out amongst themselves, so the law of the land would allow for something like that. You're not mandated to go to court when you have a dispute between two citizens. So it's important to bear that in mind as well when it comes to understanding how we're going to apply the rules of Dina D'Malchusa Dina to the cases which we're going to be looking at. Okay, so now when it comes to the case in Fort Lauderdale, so the question is what happened? So I have here, I printed this. It took me a little while to find it because I wanted to know what it was all about. You can find many articles talking about the ordinance which was made, but you have to search in order to find it. So I actually found the ordinance. So what happened? So those, if you're not familiar with the story, essentially sometime in November, I think it was, maybe the end of October, newspaper articles came out over the fact that an ordinance had been passed in Fort Lauderdale, prohibiting, at least this is the way the articles portrayed it, prohibiting the feeding of the homeless in certain public areas. And there's an elderly gentleman, I think he works at a church, who's 90, I don't even remember his name, but he, I think I put his picture on the front of the front of the thing here. Yeah, on the front of the book, that's one of the pictures of him serving food. So he was cited for serving food in defiance of this ordinance, and arrested a couple times. Sometime at the beginning of December, a judge put a stay on these citations and arrests, saying, we're going to leave it be for 30 days, let people go, and just let them do what we're going to be doing. Why did that happen? Because there was an outcry in the media over, oh, the Fort Lauderdale is heartless and soulless, they're preventing people from feeding the homeless. So let me read to you what the ordinance says when it comes to outdoor food distribution centers. Outdoor food distribution centers shall be subject to the following. If a dining area is provided, it shall meet all state, county, and city requirements for food service establishments or similar uses. It shall not be closer than 500 feet from another food distribution center or outdoor food distribution center. It shall not be any closer than 500 feet from a residential property, as defined in Section 47-35 of the ULDR. It shall provide restroom facilities, portable toilets, or other similar facilities for persons preparing and serving food, as well as for the persons being served food. It shall provide equipment and procedures for the lawful disposal of waste and wastewater at the location. Shall provide equipment and procedures at the location for hand washing. Shall provide written consent from the property owner to conduct that activity on that property. Shall have one person who will be present at the location at all times that food is being prepared and served, who has received food service manager certification under section 509.039 Florida statutes. Shall have adequate storage of food at a temperature of 41 degrees or below, or 135 degrees or above. Shall provide transportation of food in a clean conveyance. Shall provide service of food within 4 hours of preparation. Where non-prepackaged food is served, a convenient hand-washing facility for persons preparing and serving the food, which hand-washing facility must at a minimum include a 5-gallon container with a spigot that provides free-flowing water and a catch bucket to collect wastewater from hand-washing, soap and individual paper towels. Any wastewater generated at a location, including but not limited to wastewater from hand washing, utensil washing, sinks and steam tables, must be placed in a container approved by the director until properly disposed of into a sanitary sewer system or in a manner that is consistent with federal, state, and local regulations and requirements relating to liquid waste disposal. Now, we listen to all that. Okay, it's bureaucracy, whatever you want to say about it. But you listen to all that, and it's not saying you can't feed the homeless. It's saying that if you're going to be feeding people in some type of place, you need to get a permit, you need to provide for hygiene, proper hygiene, you need to have proper places for people to use the facilities, and the food must be handled in ways following the laws of health and hygiene and food services, etc. That's what the law is saying. If that can't be followed, then do it somewhere else. Do it under a different facility. The law doesn't say you can't serve people in your church, in your synagogue. The law doesn't say you're not allowed to feed the homeless. The law says, the ordinance, whatever you want to call it, is saying that certain conditions must be met. And obviously, if a person goes into a public park and doesn't have these rules, which just follow the guidelines of proper and healthy food service industry, so they're going to be in defiance of this law. If you take a look at the top piece of information which I gave you on page 7, you'll see I gave you the URL at the end from this website, nationofchange.org, where it says police arrest 90-year-old two pastors feeding homeless people. So they recite this statistic, that over 30 cities across the nation have outlawed or are considering criminalizing the provision of food to homeless people. According to the National Coalition for the Homeless, over 20 cities have devised laws against giving food to homeless people since January 2013. Okay, so With the information that we saw before about Dina de Malchusa Dina and where it's applicable, so is this a lone wolf? Is Fort Lauderdale the only city out there which is doing this? Clearly it's not. Fort Lauderdale actually is later. If we're talking about over 30 cities, or over 20, I mean, cities across the nation, 20 cities which have made laws. So, I mean, they call it criminalizing the provision of food to homeless people. This doesn't criminalize it. It just says do it under certain conditions. So this is not something in which the rules, in other words, that allow for the violation of Dina de Malchusa Dina apply, because there's precedent in other places for this. What really happened? How did I even think about this question? So Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg, who writes from the Boker Tom Synagogue, writes a blog on a weekly basis. And one week he posted on Facebook that he was looking for information and opinions about this subject. And so some people started to chime in. And one particular rabbi who is a little bit of an activist, I shouldn't say a little bit, he's a very, very much of an activist. So he posted, his response was, this is pure rishus, this is sodomy. Okay, now, I looked up the definition of the word sodomy. Okay, now, you can say that there's midas sodom. It happened to be that these articles came out on the week of Parshas Lech Lecha, when Lot and Avram have the conversation. You know, Avram says, "You choose where you're going to want to live, and I'm going to and I'll stay, and I'll go wherever you don't choose." And Lot chooses to go to Sodom. Now, what we know from the Midrash about Sodom, and even the Torah tells us about Sodom, that Anshei Sodom Ra'im V'Chata'im La'Hashem, the people of Sodom were very bad. And the Midrash is replete with details and information about the people of Sodom, how they were not into sharing, and they didn't care for guests, and that they were horrible people, and let's accept that as true. Okay? So we can call this maybe if it is in fact what the media articles were saying about it, that it is a character trait of the people of Sodom. Calling it sodomy is just, you know, for somebody who likes the English language and who appreciates language, it just doesn't really follow. So we got into a little bit of a conversation, which I will admit perhaps went a little bit overboard, where my first response was, okay, let's use English properly. This isn't sodomy. Sodomy is a very different act. It is an act which may be a little, you know, belligerent, may not be the nicest thing in the world, but let's understand the ordinance and why it is. We're trying to focus on health. We're trying to take care of. And if you read all the articles where the people who are promoting these laws and ordinances, what they're talking about is, is not as much taking it out against the homeless, but perhaps, first of all, this is a dina de malchusa. It's not a dina de malcha. It's not a mayor or a town councilman or an alderman saying, this is the rule, this is the law, and it's because I have a thing against homeless people. All of the articles say that the reason why they're doing this is to maintain the aesthetics of their town, the health and hygiene of those who are eating the food, and those who are presenting it need to follow certain rules, because we don't want to have any type of health epidemic on account of this. And also, it's not so much a war against the homeless, because homeless can be fed in other places. What they talk about is perhaps a war against the cycle of homelessness. Okay, now, anybody who's ever had a rodent problem or a cockroach problem in your house knows the first thing that the pest control people tell you, and please, I'm not comparing people to pests, but I want you to understand where they're coming from, is that if you have a problem, the first thing you need to do is you need to get rid of the food, because that's what's attracting all these people. Now, homelessness is obviously a very terrible ill of our society, and it's a real stain on society that the fact that 50 years since, what's his name, LBJ, declared a war on poverty. The war on poverty is worse than it's ever been. Okay, so that becomes a different question for society. How do we deal with that? But the argument which is made by the city council people and whoever it is that's promoting these ordinances is, listen, we have systems in place. If you're going to be doing this, you're taking away from the way in which government tries to assist these people, which is to get them into programs to get them out of homelessness, to get them into shelters. Now, the argument on the other side is, well, your shelters aren't adequate enough. You don't have enough facilities. You're not supplying enough to get people out of the cycle of homelessness. So that's a discussion which needs to be had. And obviously, a town and any city which wants to address these issues needs to do that. But I don't think that if you read the rules as it is presented, I don't think that it is Midas Sodom per se, because you can open up your church and you could do it there, because your church has facilities, your church has sinks, your church has a kitchen, your church has ways in which you could provide this in a proper fashion, and you can take it. We're not monitoring your church any way more than we're monitoring a cafeteria or any other facility that serves food. You're allowed to do it under such a rubric and under such a roof, and that is something which we're encouraging to do. And what we're trying to do is we don't want people ruining the lawn of private property, and we don't want people ruining a public space. You want to feed people in a public space? Great, get a permit, follow all the rules which we provided, and you can do it. So to say that this is something which needs to be, I mean, this activist rabbi who I mentioned before was saying there needs to be civil disobedience. And I don't think that he read the ordinance. I don't think that he was reading the rules as provided. And I called him on that as such. And of course, that's when he said, I'm not participating in this conversation because you're attacking me. I'm like, no, I'm attacking your argument because you're not bringing facts. You're speaking from your heart and not from your emotion and not from the facts on the ground, which is what they're trying to do. So it's important to understand that, and therefore I think that dina de malchusa dina does apply. We're allowed to have what I called before conscientious objection. Hey, you could say, hey, listen, we don't like this, and therefore we're going to make a protest, and we're going to go to City Hall, and we're going to fight against this in whatever way that the law allows us, and we're going to get the permits to stage a protest and whatever we need to do. But to make civil disobedience and to keep on doing it, I think that the reason why the judge put a stay on it was because of the media outrage. Now, the media outrage is warranted. We could say, hey, you're taking it out on the homeless, and that's fair, and that's something which can be stated. But to say that the law as it is is a law which is producing a sodomite city, I think is doesn't really fit into what we understand as being following the law. And of course, Dina de Malchus Adina, law of the land, in this particular case, since it's not saying, it's not advocating, don't feed the homeless, don't do chesed, don't be kind to the needy. It's not saying that. It's just saying follow it under the rules. So the law of the land is allowed to play a role in doing that. Just to give an example, okay, there are laws out on the books against smoking in certain facilities. Okay, so are those laws where you're basically discriminating against people who smoke? Is that taking away from people's civil liberties, and says, is something which can be protested against? Or Moshe Feinstein noted in a tshuva that smoking in a room where it bothers others is prohibited. Whether we're not getting into the, obviously smoking is legal, but that's a different discussion here. But he maintains that the government is entitled to define how to deal with that situation. Similarly here, the government is entitled to define how and where we can feed the homeless or the needy under certain rules and parameters, and those rules therefore must be followed. Okay. Let's move on to a much more heated topic, and that is the question of how would halacha rule in the cases of death by police that have been in the news. So, you know, it's poignant that this question actually comes up. A couple days ago, two New York City police officers were murdered in their car, just sitting in their car, by an activist who afterwards killed himself. And he apparently reported he proclaimed on Twitter, on Facebook, on one of these social media sites, that he was going to be doing this to get back the death of what's the fellow in Garner, Eric Garner, in New York City. And so that's obviously a horrible tragedy, and that's something which we do not tolerate under any stretch of the imagination. In the outline I put here that the stories about police go both ways. If you go on YouTube or type in Police Benevolent Association video, you'll see horrific images of police who now have in many cities they have a camera on their dashboards. You can see what's going on in front of their car. A police officer pulls somebody over, and he pulls up to the window and they shoot him. I mean, these are horrible things which you could see on these police benevolent videos. I've seen a number of them. Just in preparation for this, and the officers obviously put their lives on the line, and it's not something which should be tolerated in a civil society. On the other hand, sometimes officers do abuse their power. I saw a ridiculous video of a police officer in a New York subway. Obviously, there was no violence in this particular case, but there was a fellow who was playing his guitar in the subway, and the police officer starts telling him, "Put away your guitar. You're not allowed to do that." So the guy cites the law for the police officer that says, "I am allowed to do this." And the police officer takes out his law book and he starts reading it, where it says, you know, subway music can be played under certain circumstances. And as the police officer is reading the law that allows the guy to play, the guy's like, you see? And the police officer says, "All right, well, you still have to put that away. Why, officer, why?" And the officer gets into a confrontation with him, and they eventually, he calls for backup, and other officers come in, they take away the guy's guitar, and they arrest him. Okay, now, it's a bizarre scene. Everyone there is like, "Hey, officer, let the guy play. He plays here all the time. And you just read the law which allows it." So obviously in that particular case, that maybe it was an ego trip for the officer in question, but I mean, that is what it was. If you Google the names Roy Sherman, Marcus Jeter, I just saw this article about this fellow Marcus Jeter who was just they dropped the charges because of a police cam which was in the police. I don't remember what city this was in, but Marcus Jeter is a black man who was arrested over 2 years ago because the police came, they pulled him over for just profiling him. And when they got to his window, he puts his hands up and he's complying with whatever they're saying. They pull him out of the car and they throw him to the ground, and he's not resisting arrest. And the officer, using not very nice language, says, "Why are you resisting arrest? Why are you resisting arrest?" And when this video surfaced, which the officers in question, after they beat him and they tasered him and they arrested him, when this video surfaced, the prosecutors against him dropped the case, saying, I'm sorry. And they turned the case on the police officers who for over abusing their power. And the case of Roy Sherman, you can Google it, you can find these things there, but they're fascinating. So in other words, the point that I'm trying to bring out is that obviously people are human, nobody's perfect, people make mistakes, and in the particular question of the cases which took place in Ferguson over the summer, and in New York, well, I don't remember the dates, but the case in New York City, these mistakes had tragic consequences. Now, it's obviously a lot more complicated in terms of what happened in Ferguson, because there was a very lengthy grand jury hearing and hundreds of hours of testimony given to the grand jury before they decided not to indict the officer who shot Michael Brown. If you look at the officer's testimony, of course, you know, we don't know who's telling the truth and who's not telling the truth, but much of the testimony which was applied in the particular case. So it sounds like the person Michael Brown attacked the police officer in a number, you know, a couple of times, and tried to get his gun. And the police officer, and obviously, even if a person is unarmed, if you can get at somebody else's gun, then and if you're bigger than the person who has the gun, then and you can do that, then you can be considered a threat. And the officer in question, eventually, after using judgment, saying, "Look, it's my life or his," because he's charging at me. So he felt that that's what he had to do. So he shot Michael Brown, and Michael Brown died. Not going into the question of the fact that Michael Brown had recently robbed a store, and that he wasn't necessarily the most straight shooter in terms of, I don't want to judge the man. Obviously, he was unarmed and he is dead. But as I mentioned at the outset, had he listened to the officer who said to him, "Stay put and don't charge me and wait and I'm waiting for backup," then he would certainly be alive today. The officer wouldn't have shot him if he didn't feel that his life was in danger. And in the case in New York City with Eric Garner, so it's a little more clear what happened, in the sense that the man was tackled by the police and somebody put an arm around his neck, and obviously if he said he couldn't breathe, which is on the video, then in whatever manner he felt that he couldn't breathe, if a person can talk, a person can breathe. So you know, what does that mean? We've all said it at some point in time or another. You know, my children might say that if I'm tickling them too much, "I can't breathe. I can't breathe." But they can breathe, and I'm not knocking what happened. Obviously, the man is dead, and that is a tragedy. But again, if he had listened to the police and not resisted arrest, I'm not saying the police are totally innocent. But at the same time, what are you doing to the police that they have to arrest a man for selling cigarettes on the street? This is a difficult question that cities and lawmakers need to look internally and say, what are we attacking? What's right and what's wrong? So that's a different question which needs to be looked at. But at the same, so you know, the cases are a question for juries to decide, or for lawmakers to decide, and for the public to decide. But we want to look at it tonight from the perspective of what does halacha have to say, and therefore how would halacha judge in these particular cases? So the simple matter is, you know, when it comes to cases of wrongful death, halacha says that there needs to be witnesses and warning, edim v'hasra'a, and if those were not, and if, in other words, to the person who was either committing the crime or the person whose life was in danger, otherwise, habala hargacha shkem lahargo, so the officer, if his life was in danger, he would be completely, it wouldn't even come to a grand jury. I mean, maybe you'd want to look into, you'd want to make an investigation, but habala hargacha shkem lahargo means if somebody's coming to kill you, you get up first and you kill that person because your life is more important. There wouldn't even be a question when it comes to that police officer. When it comes to the case in New York City, where the person, I don't know if he was a physical threat to the police officers. Obviously, there were a lot more police, but he was a larger man, and what that translated to again is a tragedy. So it would not be as clear. I mean, the video evidence. I mean, that's why you have the investigation which you have. But I don't know that the police would come down. I don't know if the ruling would go against the police in that particular case in halacha either, especially in light of what we're about to see. Okay, Devarim Perek Tazayin. So please, we're on page 7. This is the pasuk in the Torah which tells us that we need to have laws, lawmakers, and people who carry out the following of the law. So I didn't translate it, but most of these sources are pretty short, straight, and to the point, and we'll go through this quickly. The pasuk in the beginning of Parsha Shoftim tells us, Shoftim v'shotrim titen l'cha b'chol sherecha sher Hashem l'kecha nosein l'chol l'shvatecha v'shatu esa amishpat tzedek. You have to put judges and officers in all of your gates, and they should judge a righteous judgment wherever they are. Rashi tells us, Shoftim dayanim haposkim esadin. Shoftim translates to judges who decide the law, and shotrim, what are shotrim? Harodin esa amachar mitzvosam. Those who enforce the laws, essentially to follow the mitzvos that the judges are ruling upon. Shemakin v'kofsin b'makel v'rtzua ad sheyekabel alav es din ha-shofet. That they're literally hitting and forcing people with a stick or with a strap, you can call it a whip, until people are accepting the law of the judgment. B'shotrim, Ibn Ezra says, Heim ha-moshlim, these are those who rule over, m'gzira shoter moshel, somebody who is, in other words, people who are making sure that the law is followed. V'chein mishtaro, second line, v'atam ki ha-shofet yishbot v'ha-shoter yachriach ha-mi'uvas, that the shofet, the judge, is the one who judges, and the shoter, he's the one who enforces. Okay, and he gives an example that Yehoshaphat put shotrim in all of the gates. Rabbeinu Bachaye says, shoftim hem ha-chachamim, judges are the wise people, yodei das v'din, those who know the laws, shenosin nesadin, that they tell people what the law is, v'shotrim hem ha-machrichan nesadin, and the shotrim are those who enforce it. Elu ba'alei makel, ritzua, sovim ba'ir, m'shotetim b'chotoseah, letakein kol mu'uvas, these are the enforcers who are walking around, as we saw in Rashi, with stick and strap in order to enforce the law, and to make sure that measurements and weights are being done properly, and they're all following the laws that the judges have established. The Targum Yonatan, so I gave it to you in Aramaic, but the Keser Yonatan is the Hebrew translation, which I prefer to read because it's a little easier. Shofte emes, you need to put true judges, v'shotrim alimim, and strong shotrim, strong officers. Tamnu lachem b'chol sharechem, shehashem lokechem nosein lachem. That's what you have to do, strong officers. Why do they need to be strong? So they can enforce the law. Turn over the page. Okay, so there's a Midrash Tanayim that gives an example. And of course, this plays into that what I call here the irony of ironies. And this is, we're finally on the last page. Midrash Tanayim on Devarim Perek Tzayin Pasuk Yichaz tells us the following. Okay? Shoftim v'shotrim, heki shoftim l'shotrim. There's a comparison made between judges and officers. Ma shoftim b'nei bris, just as the shoftim, the judges, are part of the covenant, of shoftim b'nei bris. So the shoftim, the officers, the police officers also have to be part of the covenant. Ma shoftim b'chol, av shoftim b'chol. Okay, in other words, there has to be a parallel. The same rules apply to the shoftim and the shoftim, whether they have to be Jewish or what b'chol means. Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua Omer, im yesh shoter, if you have a police officer, then you have to have a judge. And if there's no police officer, then there's no judge. How does this play out? So if two people come to a judge, and the judge pronounces, you're innocent and you're guilty, to each other, whichever one, and they go outside, if they say, I'm not listening to what the guy said, then what can the judge do? He's not an enforcer. He doesn't have the opportunity to enforce the law, as it were. He's just a judge. He's a weak guy, but he's a brain who sits behind a bench. So he can't do anything. Lefikach, Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, shoftim v'shotrim titen l'cha. Mi she'eno shamei l'shoftim, yishma l'shotrim. That's why the Torah tells us you have to put shoftim, you have to put judges, and you also have to put shotrim, you have to put police officers, who will enforce the law. They're not going to listen to the judge, but they're going to listen to the police officer. V'amrinan, and it brings a proof from Shmuel Beis, the second book of Samuel, and Divrei Hayamim Aleph, the first book of Chronicles, Vayihi David oseh mishpat u'tzedakah l'chol amo, that David, King David, would do judgment and righteousness for his whole nation. V'samechlei, and right near that it tells us, V'yoav ben Tzeruya al tzavah, that Yoav ben Tzeruya, David's general, he was in charge of the army. V'chimai eskol shel Yoav eitzel adayan. What's the connection between Yoav, the general of the army, and David, the judge? Am Rabbi Eliezer, il male maklo shel Yoav, lo ya David yachol asos nesadin. Were it not for the stick, the rod of Yoav, who enforced the law, then David's beautiful justice and righteousness wouldn't have been worth anything. Because who's going to listen to King David if he has no way to enforce it? So you need to have somebody who's going to enforce the law. Now, we can get into the question, as I said before, about whether the laws are proper. The thing with Eric Garner is a little ridiculous, you know, from a perspective. Here's a guy selling something which is not going to be taxed, and therefore you're going to arrest him? Okay, you know, let's have a conversation. Let's, you know, but to arrest and certainly to put in a chokehold, there's no, I mean, there isn't really a justification for that. But at the same time, if the law isn't enforced by those who are put out to enforce the law, so whose hands are being tied? Is it the citizens of the state, the citizens of the city, or is it the police officers who have to carry out the law? So who's really at fault? Is it the police or is it the lawmakers? And if it's the lawmakers, then how can we hold the police accountable for carrying out the law as they are mandated to by the shoftim that you put in all your land? We know that the Noahide laws says that one of the things that the nations of the world have to do is to set up courts and to set up a justice system. And so, as we talk about Dina de Malchus Adina, the law of the land, so if you're living in a place where there's courts, so great, that's something which needs to be supported and that's something which needs to be affirmed, especially by the Jewish community. So when we look at this case and we say, you know, this is what it is, and therefore, I mean, you know, I put on the front the question of Black Lives Matter versus police Lives Matter. All lives matter, okay? And to say no, it's only this group or it's only this group. I saw one video of that Glenn Beck put out, whether you like him or not, but some things which he says are very poignant and very true, where he was reading many black youths in Chicago who were murdered over the course of November and over the course of December and over the course of October and over the course, and the numbers only go up. And where does this happen in Chicago? Who's killing them? It's not police, okay? It's their own community which is killing them. And he says, where's the outrage? Where's the outrage? And it's a very important point to bear in mind. Now, and he gave statistics of how many white on black crimes there were versus police on anybody, police on black, police on white, doesn't matter. And the outrage versus the outrage within a community where they're killing each other all the time and where there is no outrage, it's these types of cases which make it to the media. So there is an outrage which we need to have and which all citizens of the country need to have over murder in general and what takes place in communities. And it's not just police, and it's not even just police. The police are the anomaly. It's within communities that these things happen, and to say that it's only in these particular cases that there's outrage, there should be outrage across the board. All lives matter, and whatever communities and cities and towns and the country can do in order to alleviate crime in general, and so that these types of things shouldn't happen, if people listen to police and say, hey, you know, put your hands up, or put, you know, let me see your hands, and don't charge me, and I'm going to arrest you. So these types of things, I believe, wouldn't happen. I don't think that there are vigilante police who are looking to kill people just because they're a certain color or just because they're doing certain crimes. I think that police have to protect themselves. And while the case in New York City and the case in Ferguson are, as I said, tragic because both of these people were unarmed, but we can weigh the merits of, was the police officer in danger? Was the police officer not in danger? And certainly from the perspective of what we just read here, when it comes to shoftim v'shotrim, it's important that there are police who carry out the law. If we don't like the law, so that goes back into the phrase which I mentioned before of what we call conscientious objection, where people can protest and they could say, you know, the laws are no good, we need to change it, but the police can't necessarily be held accountable for carrying out the laws as they may be. Okay, now the irony of ironies is the following. You know, when we looked at the Midrash Tanaim, we saw that David is the judge, and he says what the law is, and Yoav is the guy who carries out the law. Okay, but if you know the history about what happened between David and Yoav, take a look at the last source here. Malachim Aleph Perek Beis, this is when King David is telling his son Shlomo, King Solomon, or who's about to be King Solomon after David dies, he says to him, look, you know, Gamata Yadata Asher Asali Yoav Ben Tzruya Asher Asali Shnei Sarei Tzvos Yisrael Avner Ben Ner V'lam Sub Ben Yeser. You know what Yoav did to me when he killed Avner Ben Ner and when he killed Amasa Ben Yeser and Vayar Game, Vayasim Demei Melchama B'Shalom, and he created civil wars because there was peace in the land at the time. And he says in the last line, "Yasisa kachach masecha, you Shlomo have to do according to your own wisdom." Velo sereid seva sobe shalom shaol. Don't let Yoav get away with that. What did Yoav do? We don't have to read it here, but essentially the stories that Yoav had, what happened was, the first story which I gave you here, Shmuel Beis, Perek Beis, shortly after the death of King Saul. So Abner, who had been the general of Shaul, was running away from some circumstance, and Yoav's brother Asael chased after him. Now David pardoned Abner. He said, "You know, you're a good guy. You were on the wrong side because after Shaul died, I'm the one who's supposed to be king." But David offered him a hand of peace, saying, "You know, you're a good general, and I want you on my side." Asael chased after Abner, and he was going to kill him. And Abner says to him, "Asael, what are you doing here?" And Asael says, "I'm going to get you." And Abner, who was an amazing soldier, took a spear which he was holding and just threw it this way into Asael, who was Yoav's brother, and he killed him. But Abner was following the law, which is if somebody's coming to chase after you to kill you, whose life comes first? You're allowed to kill him. See, he was allowed to do that, and therefore, in David's view, David, who is the judge, says, "You're free. Somebody's chasing after you to kill you. You're allowed to kill the person in self-defense." Now, obviously, Yoav, this is his brother. So Yoav wasn't pleased with it. And Yoav, in the second section, which you have here, Shmuel Beis Perek Gimel, he takes his opportunity at some point. He invites Abner in a very deceiving way. He invites Abner and pretends to have a flower of peace with him, and he kills Abner in cold blood. Amasa was a general who David had hired, and Yoav was jealous of him because he's a younger guy, and Yoav felt that he was being shafted and thrown out. So Yoav killed Amasa as well, and this is but in cold blood. There was no cause for it, no justification whatsoever, and that's why David said to Shlomo that you have to take the law to Yoav. Because there are times when even the police officer who carries the law may go too far or may be subject to the law himself. Now, in these particular cases, Yoav wasn't, I mean, in Abner, you know, he was avenging the blood of his brother. But with Amasa, there was absolutely no justification for it. And so David pronounced judgment to Shlomo, saying, "Look, I can't do it because Yoav and I had a kinship and it's not for me, but you're going to be taking over. You have to carry out the law against Yoav, because even though Yoav was my chief of police, the bottom line is that even the chief of police could be guilty of a crime." And in Yoav's case, it was. So that's the irony of ironies, that even somebody who's carrying out the law, in some cases, has to be subject to the law, because he's taken the law into his own hands. So when it comes to, just to summarize what we've seen before, what we've seen up until now. So we talked about Dina de Malchus Adina, and how Dina de Malchus Adina applies, certainly from a Jewish perspective. You have to follow the law of the land unless it particularly contradicts the Torah. When it comes to the case in Fort Lauderdale, it doesn't contradict the Torah because the homeless are, we're not being told don't feed the homeless. We're being told do it under certain circumstances for the sake of cleanliness and hygiene and whatever other factors we outline. And so Dina de Malchusa has to apply, and even civil disobedience is not warranted or called for. Maybe for the particular law, we can have a conscientious objection. You can protest in whatever manner in front of City Hall. But to start feeding people in a manner which is against the law, according to Jewish law, is inappropriate. People are going to do that, and a judge is going to put a stay. Okay, but that's the law of the land, and they can play that law. They can play that game if they want. But from a Jewish perspective, I believe that is inappropriate. The law has to be followed. And if you want to, you're allowed to advocate and say to your representatives, "We don't like this, and here's why," and we can make petitions, and we can do whatever we can to change the law. That's certainly appropriate. But Dina de Malchus Adina tells us that the law and the rule must be followed. And when it comes to halacha ruling in the case of the death by police that have been in the news, So the Torah seems to tell us that there are judges and there are laws, and the laws must be followed. And I do believe that if the laws would be followed, and even if the laws are broken, when the shotrim come along and say, "Hey, we have to take you in because you're not following the law," obviously if that would be followed, then the people in question would be alive, and they'd be following according to the halacha of how we have shoftim and shotrim. We have judges and we have people who carry out the law. And certainly, while we mourn the deaths of anybody who dies under tragic circumstances or any circumstances, the halacha would side with the police in these in these particular cases, because the police are carrying out the law which is advocated by a malchus shel chesed, what we view the United States as being a kingdom of kindness, where laws are made by consensus, where laws are made by lawmakers who are elected, when laws are made by people who are voted into office, and where we are allowed to say, if we don't like the laws, hey, we don't like the laws, and let's change things. And that is certainly a possibility which is afforded to all citizens of the land to petition and to say we don't like it. But when it comes to the ruling of these cases vis-a-vis Dina de Malchus Adina, I believe that the law obviously should be followed, but also that the law would even fit into as things have played out, would fit into where the judgments as they were, if there need to be judgments, would follow as they were, following the rules of the Torah.